Mircha could scheme all he wanted. She was going to do what she wanted to do. "Do what you want with your life," I told her. "You have to live with it. I'm going to live mine while I still have one." I got up and slammed out of the room and into another world. Chapter 54. Mircha, Venice, 1458.
Merda.
Mircha grabbed the witch, clapped a hand over her mouth, and spun the two of them back against a wall, and into the shadow of the second story of a house, the kind Venetians like to push out over the street to gain themselves a little more room. He thickened the shade around them as much as he could, but his heart was still in his throat, as what had to be 100 vampires rushed past the opening of the alley just a few feet away. He stayed stock still, the woman flat against him, her frantic heartbeat sounding like thunder in his ears, and probably in their pursuers, too, only it was drowned out by real thunder from above. The last soldier finally passed, but Mircha stayed in place a little longer, not because of worry that they'd double back, but more because he couldn't get his body to move. It seemed to like the freezing cold wall just fine. But the witch didn't and started beating on him, so he let her go, only to find his arm clutched in a surprisingly strong grip.
"How the hell are we supposed to get through this?" she hissed. "They're every—"
Mircha's hand clapped back over her mouth, winning him a glare worthy of a praetor. He ignored it. Thunder was crashing like ocean waves above them and echoing off the high, close-packed walls all around. Rain was bucketing down, causing water to cascade off roof lines and shoot out of gutters, crisscrossing the narrow streets with liquid arcs like suspended canals. Meanwhile, the real canals rushed like rivers, adding their roar to the cacophony. But vampire hearing could not be underestimated.
"Not allowed,"
Mircha thought at her, as hard as he could. She jerked and stared at him, eyes wide and startled, and Mircha felt welcome relief flood through him. It was easier to communicate mind to mind with his own kind. Humans were more problematic, especially magical ones. And God knew nothing else had gone right tonight, but now at least they could talk. Only the witch didn't seem to agree, because he'd no sooner released her again than she started screaming.
"Ah!"
"Stop it," he thought at her frantically.
"Ah!"
"Shut up.
You're going to get us. Ooh!"
The last was because she just elbowed him in the ribs, which hadn't mattered, and then kicked him in the shin, which had. Mircha's still-healing bone sent a spear of pain lancing through him, and the witch took the opportunity to scramble away, bouncing off the narrow walls and looking crazed. Mircha tackled her halfway down the alley, but slipped on some muck, sending them sliding into a wall and giving her the chance to kick him viciously in the face and run. He felt the little space slur around him, and his eyes go fuzzy for a moment.
Damn it, they couldn't afford this.
Then his vision snapped back, allowing him to spot her, silhouetted by a burst of lightning in the middle of a small bridge and glowing like a beacon.
Merda!
A moment later, the light flicked out, plunging the scene into darkness. But the heavens cracked open again almost immediately, along with a cannon boom of thunder, showing Mircha a party of the praetor's guards instead, their shiny breastplates running with lightning and all but glowing against the now empty bridge, because the witch had disappeared. The light faded, and Mircha hugged cobblestones, hoping against hope that his dark hair and clothes would hide him. And he guessed they did, because the guard's steps pounded in another direction, and he clambered back to his feet, his mind whirling with fear and confusion. He limped down the alley to the little bridge, but still saw nothing, which was impossible. No human moved that fast. And she'd said she was out of power, so what? Oh, that was what. A rogue pain had caused Mircha to look down at his calf, just as a dimmer scrawl of lightning flared overhead. It was less blinding than illuminating, in more than one way. He retraced his path, stepped off the bridge, and knelt beside the small rickety structure to peer underneath, and saw the witch huddled in the freezing water up to her neck, probably hoping it would muffle her heartbeat, which it hadn't, and that it would hide her from the guards, which it had, but only because they'd been distracted by the storm, one that couldn't last much longer. Myrta slid down the muddy bank and got on her level. The witch's flame-red hair had been part of a glamoury she could no longer maintain, leaving mousy brown locks to straggle dispiritedly around a face that was less alluring at the moment than pinched and pale and freckled. She had brown eyes, too, not unattractive in their own way, but a far cry from the luminous blue she'd been wearing, not to mention that everything she had on was soaked. She looked like a drowned rat, a very frightened one. For a long moment, Myrta simply knelt there, listening to the skies, which sounded like they'd had some of Horatiu's infamous garlic torta. He didn't want to spook the witch more than she already was, but they couldn't stay here. They couldn't stay anywhere. They were being hunted, and the noose was tightening, because their little ruse hadn't worked. Well, that wasn't entirely true. They'd managed to float away from the pier under a bit of flotsam, while everyone else stared at the burning gondola or ran for cover. The latter had been the popular choice, since vampires are even more flammable than humans, and they'd just seen two people incinerated. But while the distraction had helped him and the witch get away, it hadn't done much else. By the time they'd swum a safe distance, they'd barely had the strength to drag themselves onto dry land again. But they'd nonetheless been forced into a mad scramble through streets still teeming with vampires, too many of them. Their pursuers should have been heading for home, or for the taverns and betting parlors, where hunting was still to be had, and some of them were. But those were mainly the locals who had been pressed into service while the praetor mobilized her coterie of guards, who were suddenly everywhere. Because she wasn't as stupid as her creatures. She hadn't bought the lightning bolt story. Myrta and the witch had stayed alive this long only because of the storm, with the rolling thunder covering their footsteps, the pounding rain masking their scent, and the lightning causing so many helpful shadows to flicker and jump that even vampire eyes had trouble knowing where to focus. But it couldn't last much longer. They were going to die unless they got out of this city and did it soon.
"I have an idea," he said, in between thunderclaps.
The witch had been staring at the water with a blank look, the same one she now turned on him. Her moods had ranged wildly during the chase, from defiance to desperation to strange euphoria to whatever this was, but at least the panic was gone.
"That was you," she rasped. "In my head."
"Yes."
"The praetor. She used to talk to me like that. I thought..."
She licked her lips.
"I thought she'd found me."
"No."
The "not yet" remained unsaid, but floated almost tangibly in the air between them. She slowly got out of the canal, dragging heavy waterlogged skirts behind her, and then squatted, dripping on the muddy bank beside him. She was shivering, and he wished he had his cloak to offer her, but it was long gone, and would have been drenched in any case.
"I have an idea," Myrta repeated.
She didn't say anything for a long moment, just stared at the rushing water of the canal, which was wholly black in the absence of any lightning. It was almost mesmerizing, a river of ink, with only its movement making it visible at all. It felt strangely cozy, sopping wet, though they were, under this tiny bit of shelter, while the wind howled down the alleys and the little river rushed inside its banks, masking any sign of them. It was so easy to imagine that they could just stay here forever, shut away from the world. But they couldn't, something the witch seemed to realize, because she slowly turned her head to look at him.
"You're not going to like it," Myrta admitted.
"I know."
Light flashed, impossibly bright, and a waterspout exploded on a nearby building. That and a crack of thunder, loud as cannon fire, almost caused Myrta to lose his grip on the windowsill, and it did cause the witch to lose hers. He scrabbled for purchase on water-slick stone, and she screamed and started to fall, her eyes wide with terror, her hand reaching for him desperately, and snagged the hem of his shirt.
"Gah!"
Mircha experienced the unique sensation of almost being decapitated as he dangled off a third-story window ledge by a couple of fingers, while the remains of the too close lightning crawled across his body like manic worms. He did not scream, something he would have been proud of if his throat hadn't been too indented to allow it, but he did curse inventively for a moment, in his head. Good thing he didn't need to breathe, he thought savagely, and hauled the witch back up. Below them, the little alley by the Praetor's Palazzo roared like a living thing, sweeping anything unlucky enough to land in it straight into the Grand Canal. Mircha knew that because they'd just waded across, the witch clinging to his back, while debris battered them and winds shook them and lightning threatened to roast them. And damn it all, he wasn't doing that again. He pushed the window the rest of the way open with his chin, dragged the witch up, and shoved her through, and then scrambled after her, and promptly slipped on a dish of slimy little fish that had been left to rot on the floor.
"You're right. I don't like it,"
the witch hissed at him. Why, Mircha didn't know. He was the one whose private parts had just become intimately acquainted with the hard edge of a table. Very hard. God, so hard. He bit back an unmanly sob and stared into the darkness for a moment, before glancing around the small study belonging to the Praetor's secretary, hoping for a light. But of course not. The only one at the moment was the moon, flirting with the storm clouds outside, and she was a coy bitch. They'd never find anything like this.
Here.
The witch thrust a candle in his face that she'd seemingly pulled out of nowhere.
Oh, did you find that?
Stepped on it.
She paused and then cocked her head at him.
Are you out of breath?
No.
I thought vampires didn't have to breathe.
They don't.
Then what's wrong with...
Nothing. Just light the damn thing.
Mircha snapped and straightened up. And yes, that hurt about as much as he thought it would. She waved the bent candle at him impatiently.
I'm out of magic, remember?
You can't even light a damned candle.
I could hold it out the window and hope the lightning hits it, if you think that would help.
Her eyes narrowed on him.
Or you could.
Their brief rapport under the bridge appeared to have faded, probably due to almost getting caught a dozen times since then. He had foolishly thought the streets would be clearer near the Praetor's mansion, because what kind of idiots would dare to come here?
Our kind, Mircha thought,
and limped next door with the candle. He discovered that the secretary's bedroom was even more of a disaster than the cubbyhole, with stinking piles everywhere. But it did have a low-banked fire burning across from the bed, which managed to light the wick.
All right, then.
He re-entered the small study and placed the thing on top of a cabinet, where it did little more than gild the darkness. But it would have to do. The witch started searching through the heaps on the floor, including one that contained a pair of unwashed hosen that she had some low-voiced curses for, while Mircha broke open an elaborate ivory box, rifled through the papers on the table, pawed through a little slanted writing desk, checked out a bookcase, and even shook out some fine green draperies, in case something had fallen into the creases, but found only dust. The Praetor's shield was missing.
You're sure it's kept here?
The witch whispered, looking as frustrated as he felt.
Of course I'm sure. I've used it before.
Well, didn't you ever see where it was kept?
Here.
Mircha picked up the ivory case and thrust it at her.
It's supposed to be right here.
Well, it's not.
I know that.
And without it, we're not going anywhere.
I know that, too.
I hope so,
she said grimly, shoving sodden hair out of her face.
If you expect me to somehow shield us in the ley lines, you're going to be very disappointed. I couldn't manage that at my strongest. I definitely can't do it now.
Mircha bit back a sharp comment, because it wasn't fair. Weak the witch might be, but he was no better.
Damn it, they had to have that shield.
Without it, they would be dead by morning, if not sooner. But with it, his fist clenched. He had visited Abramalin in far-off Egypt and come back the same night. The ley lines were terrifying but also unbelievably fast and seemed to crisscross the entire world, meaning they could go anywhere, anywhere at all, including Paris, to tip off the consul about the damned praetor. He started searching the desk again.
"You've done that already,"
the witch whispered.
"Perhaps I missed something."
"I was watching. You didn't."
Mircha whirled on her.
"If you have a better idea, I'd love to. Damn it."
He had knocked a half-full glass of wine off the overcrowded table, which shattered against the hard tile of the floor. Both of them froze, waiting for startled cries and running feet. But none came. After a moment, the witch let out a breath, and Mircha felt his spine unclench. The praetor was having another of her endless parties, and the servants were overworked as it was. They weren't going to look for messes to clean up. His thoughts stuttered to a halt as he watched the puddle of wine, gleaming like blood in the low light, drain away under the wall, until there was nothing left, just a vague pink stain on the floor.
"What is it?"
the witch asked as he knelt beside it.
"I'm not sure."
He ran his fingers over the fine scroll work on the paneling. It had an anchithous leaf design interspersed with rosettes, none of which appeared to be movable. But when he tapped faintly on the wall above the stain, it sounded hollow. He looked up at her.
"Perhaps another room?"
"What are you talking about?"
The witch leaned over his shoulder.
"What other room?"
A section of wall suddenly slid back behind another, leaving an opening just big enough for a person to fit through. Mircha looked up at her.
"That one."
The hidden room was dark, even by vampire standards. It looked like it had a window, the twin to the one they had crawled through, but it had been boarded up, letting in only a few thin flashes whenever a lightning bolt burst outside. But it wasn't the darkness that bothered Mircha. He was used to that. It was the smell. The anchovy and dirty clothes odor of the study was worse, mixed with months of accumulated grime, because Mircha didn't think the maids were ever allowed in here. This wasn't like that. It wasn't a bad smell, although there was a good bit of dust involved. It was just, whatever the underlying scent was, he didn't know it. And he'd thought he knew them all. After more than a decade as a vampire, Mircha had built up an impressive scent catalog in his head, despite not being a hound, what those of his kind were called who had particularly sensitive noses. He'd seen a blind one navigate a crowd once with perfect dexterity, even stopping to pick up an old woman's dropped purse and offer it back to her. He'd talked to him later in a bar and discovered that he could almost see the scent clouds in his head resolving themselves into hazy images of people, canals, even buildings, that in some ways were more distinct than anything Mircha's eyes could perceive. That vampire would probably have known everything in the room in a moment, where it was and what it was, even in pitch darkness. But Mircha wasn't that vampire, and the skin of his neck was ruffling. He motioned to the witch to hand him the candle, then pushed it through the gap and held it up, the small flame illuminating. Nothing, because a couple lanterns had just flickered to life all by themselves. He and the witch looked at each other.
"You first," she said.
Mircha went in. Chapter 55. Mircha, Venice, 1458. Mircha looked around, still not sure what he was seeing. The room looked like a storehouse for weapons, only he didn't know why anyone would bother keeping these. Baskets held sword and axe blades that were almost eaten away by rust, their pommels long since lost to time. Ragged quivers were full of arrows that looked like they'd disintegrate with a breath. An old piece of cloth, possibly a banner, judging by the shape, lay on a table, so tattered and burnt that it would have been impossible to display any other way. Yet it had once been magnificent, a heavy weight of silk with glimmers of gold here and there, their brightness undimmed by time. and it had some sort of pastoral scene painted on it, although it was so faint now that he couldn't quite make it out. He bent closer, putting out a hand, and had it grasped by the witch, hard enough to hurt.
"Careful."
Her voice was rough.
"It looks like the Praetor collects more than just human art."
Mircha frowned, not understanding, and still didn't when he raised the candle, because the lanterns left deep shadows draping the walls in places, and sent light dancing over maps he didn't recognize, books he couldn't read, and strange-looking shields with designs he had never seen. And clothing that was trying to crawl up his arm. He dropped the candle, and the witch's hand abruptly tightened, jerking him back.
"Fae," she told him before he could ask. "And old, very old. I don't even know how the spells are still active."
Mircha stared at the mail shirt, now gleaming on the floor. Unlike the weapons, it showed no ravages of time, shining as brightly as if just made. And it hadn't felt like metal, but more like silk against his skin. He'd never seen anything so fine. He looked at the witch because something had just registered.
"Fae?"
"Yes, Fae, you know."
Mircha didn't know. She put fingers beside her ears and wiggled them at him. He just stared, and then snapped out of it because they didn't have time for this.
"The Fae are a myth, a tale told to frighten children."
"Like vampires?"
Mircha stared at her some more, and then caught a pair of greaves trying to inch their way out of a basket, which was less of a concern than the fact that they'd stopped as soon as he spotted them. He looked at them, slumped innocently over the weave, and felt a hard shiver crawl up his spine.
"Be careful what you touch,"
the witch said, completely unnecessarily, and moved off to begin a search. Mircha retrieved his guttering candle and took it as far from the damned armor as he could get, only to be distracted by something on the banner. Or, to be more precise, something in the banner, which moved between the rents, shivered over the threadbare patches, and thundered across once verdant fields, now gray with age. Something that sent little puffs of dust up here and there as it traveled across the surface. Something impossible. Half in disbelief, half in wonder, Mircha edged closer, tracking the movements of tiny riders on tiny horses, silently braying hounds, beaters with their little sticks, driving prey before them, and deer that flickered in and out of sight as they fled across ghostly fields. And then off the cloth entirely, golden light that hadn't come from Mircha's candle following them as they jumped to something covered by a sheet. Mircha sidled over and gave a cautious tug. The fabric slithered away to reveal a huge, leather-bound book on a wooden stand. It was open to a page where a hunt was depicted, one he could see clearly now, because there was no corruption here. Like the mail shirt, it looked like it had been finished yesterday, the color so glossy and bright that he was almost afraid to touch it, lest he smear the paint. But he did, after a brief glance over his shoulder at the witch, who was muttering to herself and whacking at something in a basket with a piece of broken spear. Mircha turned back to the book and gingerly turned over a gossamer page, being careful to touch only the unpainted edge. And then another, and another, because they were like nothing he had ever seen. Illustrations in vibrant hues picked out in gold that would have been wondrous enough on their own. But like the ethereal hunt, they also moved. He saw nobles riding in procession, their gilded leather trappings gleaming under a painted sun, peasants tilling the land, the soil under their tiny plows so warm and rich that he swore he could smell its scent, people dancing around a painted bonfire, the little sparks glowing like jewels as they rose off the page and into the gloom, and two navies clashing in the midst of a majestic rolling sea, which sent what felt like miniature sprays of water up at him. He turned page after page, eagerly, almost hungrily. They were painted poetry, all of them, more perfect than any masterwork he had ever seen. Far more, he thought, after sighing a little too hard on a page and sending a noble's hat flying, which the tiny man scrambled around and only just managed to catch. Mircha stared at him, sure he had been mistaken, and accidentally brushed the edge of a painting, and had a very small, very angry squirrel glare at him from under the edge of his fingertip, and then push out from beneath the pad to bark at him in outrage. He grinned, utterly enchanted, and turned over another page, and felt his smile grow puzzled. That was strange. The illustration took up both pages this time, bright and colorful, like all the others, but instead of a distant view of an expansive scene, it showed only a close-up of a crowd, very close, so much so that Mircha could see virtually nothing except the backs of jostling, milling people. Something appeared to be happening up ahead, something important, judging by the animation of the crowd, but he could see little of it, just occasional glimpses of a bright blue sky and something that might be a castle on a hill. But the view was so intermittent that even that was debatable. He found himself pushing at the crowd of bodies, even poking at a fat man who refused to budge, trying to see everything. The dark little room flashed out, the fire-splashed walls giving way to a crowd of people screaming and shoving and threatening to trample him. Mircha tried to move away while he figured out what was happening, but he couldn't seem to control his body, and it wouldn't have mattered even if he could. Behind him, a double ring of guards circled the crowd, their swords out, blocking the way back. And ahead, damn it, he still couldn't see! Until the screams became shrieks, and a huge fight broke out, sending dozens to the ground and parting the crowd enough to show, oh God, not again! Mircha stumbled back, but there was nowhere to go, and nowhere to look except for the cauldron straight ahead, big as a ship and gleaming copper bright in the incongruously sunny day. Inside, a crowd of men floated motionless on the bubbling surface of the water, their long hair drifting around them, their skins sloughing off in pieces. Or else they writhed, screaming and fighting, lobster red but still trying to climb up the blistering sides, while a thick line of soldiers with spears shoved them back in. Mircha tried to avert his eyes. He'd seen enough horrors this day. But they stayed glued to the scene nonetheless, forcing him to watch as more men, waiting their turn alongside the cauldron, used their chains to strangle their fellow prisoners out of pity before they were boiled alive, while the vast crowd tore at their hair and cried and fought and... Mircha finally looked away, but only because a woman, beautiful, desperate, and tear-streaked, grabbed him. "Help us," she breathed. "You're on the Domi. Make her stop." Mircha followed her outflung arm and saw another woman, raven-haired and dark-eyed, standing on top of a terrace framed by the castle. She was watching the spectacle and laughing at the sufferers, their families, him, knowing he couldn't do anything, that if he so much as muttered a word against her, he'd join them.
"I can't help," he babbled. "I'm sorry, I'm so sorry."
"Murderer," the woman shrieked. "You may as well be killing us yourself. Do something. Those are your people."
"I'm sorry, I'm sorry."
"Stop saying that." She was shaking him, and now more people were pausing, were turning this way, were looking at him. Didn't any of them understand? He'd done all he could. Why were they looking at him with such hate? What did they expect? For him to die along with them and his family, too?
"I'm sorry,"
he screamed in the woman's face, shame and horror and panic all coming together into what felt like madness. And why not? The whole world was mad.
"I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry."
She was backing away now, but still he pursued her, screaming, crying, helpless and hating himself for it, until hard hands grasped him and strong arms pulled him back. And still he yelled,
"I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, all of you, and your descendants for generations."
The voice that finished the sentence wasn't Mircha's. It changed as the scene did, dizzyingly fast, but not back to the quiet shadows of the hidden room, but to a night with a waxing moon shining through the bare branches of a winter forest, shedding little light onto a crowded hillside. But it wasn't needed. A great ring of torches surrounded a scaffold at the top of the hill, where the largest tree of all stood in solitary splendor. Like the woman from the castle, who was standing in the middle of the platform, her long dark hair streaming like a banner in the wind, the same one that sent ribbons of fire flowing out of the torches and almost carried Mircha's voice away.
"Even now," he heard himself intone, "you cannot accept your guilt. Even now, you spit in the faces of those who would redeem you."
"Redeem?" The woman's scornful voice rang across the crowd.
"Oh, pray, forgive me, masters all. I thought you were here to kill me." "The body, lady, not the soul. I'm a queen, not a lady, and I don't give a damn about my soul."
"Some truth from her at last," someone muttered nearby.
"But we do," Mircha said gravely. "And we choose to give you one last chance."
He saw his arm rise, although it didn't look like his, with darker skin and strange attire, and beckon a huge man forward. Only, no, not a man, for he was shirtless, and his torso was strangely muscled, and his face... Mircha suddenly stared around at the faces of the crowd, noticing what he'd been too panicked to see before, because they were beautiful. Beautiful, but not right. Here was hair the color of bright green grass, there eyes like summer violets, and all of them too tall, too lithe, too alien, he thought, and wanted to run, but his feet stayed planted on the scaffold.
"For your crimes, you are cast out," he informed the woman,
as the huge executioner tried to affix a blindfold over her eyes.
"Separated forever from your home, your people, and your realm. May you find peace in your new world, and enrich it with your undoubted gifts."
"I will make it tremble."
The woman twisted out of the guard's hold, who had foolishly dropped his axe to tie the blindfold, and grabbed a knife from his belt. Before anyone could react, she'd sliced open his stomach, sending him stumbling back with his guts in his hands.
"And then I'll come after you,"
she whirled on the crowd.
"You puling cowards, you little fools, do you think you've heard the end of me?"
"Yes,"
a deep voice boomed, and the next second, the beautiful, livid face was bouncing across the boards, along with the head it was attached to, coming to rest at Mircha's feet. He looked up, stunned, at a giant blonde man with a sword in his hand and a spattering of blood across his face.
"Bury it," the man snapped, "and may the gods have pity on this world."
The vision, or whatever it was, snapped, ending as suddenly as it had begun. Mircha awoke to find the witch beating on him and screaming, "Shut up, shut up, shut up!" which wasn't good. Then he heard the sound of those running feet he'd been dreading, which was worse. Merda! He threw her off, but it didn't help. She just grabbed him again, yelling for him to keep quiet and apparently not recognizing the irony, while he looked around for a weapon that might still work, because they were about to need one, and found nothing that didn't disintegrate under his hands. So he grabbed the witch instead and shook her.
"What happened?"
"Screaming, and now they've probably heard us."
"They have heard us. They're on the way."
The witch looked startled for a moment, like she hadn't expected him to agree with her, then her face crumpled.
"I knew it. I knew it. I knew it. I knew..."
Mircha shook her some more.
"Answer me."
"What difference does it make now?"
"Tell me."
It was basically a roar, and finally snapped her out of her frenzy.
"They, the Fae, can weave memories into things like paint or cloth, letting you relive what one of them saw."
The entire wall blew in, sending paneling flying, dust billowing, and a vampire in Medusa head armor lunging for Mircha. And then writhing on the floor, seemingly possessed, as he fought with a crowd of people long dead. Mircha grabbed the witch out of the shelving she'd staggered into and towed her through the wall.
What happened? She demanded, looking back. What did you do?
Threw a book at him, Mircha said, and started out the door, only to crash into the secretary running in from the hall.
That's it. Look in his hand.
The witch pointed at something the secretary was clutching, as his startled eyes took in the two of them, something glowing like a beacon with a stronger, purer light than it had ever had before. The Praetor's shield. Mircha lunged for it, and the next thing he knew he was hitting the wall on the other side of the study. The secretary might look weak, and he wasn't a master, or Mircha would be dead already, but he wasn't a baby either. And more guards were doubtless on the way. The window was open, letting in a scattering of rain and offering a quick escape, but there was nothing but death out there. And if he was going to die, he was going down fighting, not cowering under a damned bridge. The secretary had just knocked the witch aside, and now he looked up, in time to see the resolution settle onto Mircha's face.
"You want this?"
the man sneered, holding up the orb, which had just flushed a deep, dark crimson.
"Take it."
He threw the shield right at Mircha, just as the woman sprang off the floor, a heavy tray in her hands, which she swung at the secretary's head, and hit the stone instead. The little thing slammed back into the vampire, hitting him smack in the middle of his chest. Mircha was halfway through a lunge, trying to grab the stone and the witch at the same time, only to have her grab him instead, sending both of them to the floor.
"Don't touch him! Don't touch him!"
she screamed, and this time Mircha listened, because something very strange was happening to the secretary. The long dark hair he wore in a clip had come loose and was flooding white as quickly as if someone had poured a bucket of paint over his head, like his skin, already vampire pale, was fading to alabaster, and the eyes, formerly beady and black, were now beady and blue, almost colorless. He was albino pale as he batted at the orb, which appeared to have become stuck, and he started screaming, "Get it off! Get it off! Get it off!" What looked like a whole squadron of guards appeared in the hallway behind him, but they didn't get it off. They also didn't come in, perhaps because the secretary was screaming. The guard in the hidden room was yelling that he was sorry, sorry, so very sorry, and the witch was standing in the middle of the room, breathing hard and looking fairly witchy. She'd partly dried, leaving wild tufts of muddy hair sticking up everywhere. They matched her expression, which was a cross between anger and panic that almost read as furious, and she'd just grabbed the broken spear shaft again, which was too thick for a wand, but it didn't look like the guards knew that.
"Do something," Mircha told her mentally. "Pretend to cast a spell."
She did not cast a spell. She did, however, panic at the sound of his voice in her head, habit and fear overriding good sense, which also seemed to be the case with the guards, when she suddenly ran at them, screaming and waving the wand. They fell back against the outer wall of the hall, alarm on their features, while the secretary flailed wildly and the shield finally dislodged. It fell to the ground, almost clear again, spinning around on the hard tiles of the floor. The secretary gasped and went staggering backward. The witch screamed and beat him with her stick, and Mircha swallowed and stared at the orb, and then took a calculated risk and grabbed it. Nothing happened. Nothing happened, except that it felt warm and strangely full in his palm, as if it contained far more power than before, and it had already contained enough.
"Come on!"
he yelled at the witch and held it up, and was immediately tackled by one of the guards who hadn't bought into the pantomime, until Dorina flew at the man, doing something that made him scream and flail around, and Mircha yelled,
"That's it! Curse them! Curse them all!"
Suddenly he and the witch were alone, the vampires thundering down the hallway, the secretary yelling profanity outside the door, and the guard in the hidden room sobbing apologies that echoed off the walls.
"I told you this would work,"
Mircha breathed at the witch. who whacked him with her stick very hard several times. And then they were gone.
Dory! Dory!
I opened my eyes to hardwood floors, a puddle of drool, and Claire kneeling beside me. So were Stinky, Olga, and the troll boy, whose smock was now truly a sight to behold. A handful of fey guards stood on the steps, all looking spooked. But not half as much as I was.
"Are you all right?" Claire demanded.
"No," I said, my head spinning as everything finally came together. "None of us are." Holy shit. Chapter 56. An hour later, Coffee Lover was standing in the kitchen doorway, trying to get my attention, but I couldn't hear him over all the screaming.
"What?"
His mouth moved some more, but it didn't help.
"Can you shut up for a minute?"
I asked Marlowe, only to have him round on me.
"As soon as you start making some goddamned sense."
"I have been. I told you
that an ancient fey queen turned praetor turned whatever the hell is rampaging around New York wearing a war mage's skin. Do you have any idea how that sounds?"
"Yes, but it doesn't mean I'm wrong."
"No, it means you're crazy." Marlowe snapped his fingers at his vamps. "We're leaving."
And found his arm caught by a pissed-off senator with flour in his hair. Luis Cesar had shown up just before the chief spy, and he hadn't been baking. But Marlowe had been doing a lot of fist-pounding on the kitchen table, and as a result, we were all a little starchy. Luis Cesar just made it look good.
"You're going to listen to her." "I have listened, and been fed the biggest pile of horse." "Then you can listen again. Perhaps with your mouth closed this time." "Well, shit," I thought, as Marlowe turned puce.
In fairness, he'd already been pretty close, since he didn't seem to like my Alfild as the villain theory. And while I normally wouldn't have cared what Marlowe liked, in this instance, we needed his help. Which is why I didn't respond in kind when he grabbed me, even though it left me, him, and Luis Cesar facing off on three sides of the kitchen table, and me bent halfway across it because I was too short for this, like the room was too small for a conference.
"Release me,"
Marlowe barked, ignoring the fact that he had me in the same grip. Luis Cesar did not release him. The tension ratcheted up a few more notches, and it had already been pretty high, because some of the guys Marlowe had dragged along looked vaguely familiar. Like, I might have recently shot a few familiar. I sighed and wondered if I could make it to the door without anybody returning the favor. But before I could try, Luis Cesar squeezed my other arm, completing the awkward triangle.
"Tell him."
"I already did. He doesn't want to hear—"
"Tell him anyway. Then we'll have Mircha tell him. Perhaps something will get through that thick skull." "While the only thing going through your skull," Marlowe snapped, "will be my fist if you don't let go."
Luis Cesar let go, but only so he could grab the spy's lapels and drag him over the table.
"Damn it, man, think. If she's right, the creature who attacked the council is still at large, and you're responsible for her safety. If there's any chance..."
Marlowe broke his hold with a savage upward gesture, and I thought we were going to have round number two, Electric Boogaloo, only with no holds barred this time. And since that would involve Master's powers, which in Marlowe's case included the aforementioned ability to crack skulls, I wasn't on board. But then he made an annoyed cat sound and flung out a hand in my direction.
"Fine. Tell me."
I looked at Luis Cesar, who raised an eyebrow, and then around the room, at the sea of glowering faces, and sighed again. Always nice to have an appreciative audience. "Cademan told me about Alfilt, the ancient fey princess with a rep for boiling people alive, but I didn't think much about it," I said. "But that's where our current problem started, all those years ago in Faerie, when she was betrayed and murdered, as she saw it. She was furious and vowed revenge, and that kind of anger carries over. Some of the guards told me that Fae who claim to remember substantial bits of their past lives are usually either very powerful or very troubled, and Alfilt was both.
That's one way of putting it, Luis Cesar murmured. Thanks to Marlowe's theatrics, he'd heard only bits and pieces of this himself.
Anyway, she was exiled from Faerie and executed on Earth, which should have been the end of it. Except she was Fae, and they reincarnate. But since she was on Earth now, she came back as a human, because that seems to be the way it works. The Fae soul latches onto the energy of the planet to help it form its next body, and this is a human world. But she was still Fae underneath, and kept being tormented with weird flashes of memory she didn't understand.
And with that, at least, I could sympathize. That's why she sought out a vampire, one of Marlowe's guys piped up, to give her time to figure things, out.
He trailed off when his master glared at him. Maybe, I agreed. Or maybe she just got bit randomly. Either way, a longer life allowed her to put the pieces together, enough to find her grave and that damned book, which told her the rest.
Why would the Fae leave such a thing?
Luis Cesar asked.
If they knew there was even a chance she'd remember.
The guard said that's probably why it was left, as a warning, in case she recalled anything substantial, and as a reason for her exile. It was supposed to promote repentance by reminding her of her crimes.
Yes, that works so well with homicidal maniacs, Marlowe snarled. They may as well have given her a primer, like leaving young Hitler Mein Kampf.
I didn't point out that he had no reason to be angry, since he wasn't supposed to be buying any of this, because I was just glad that he actually seemed to be listening this time, and because I agreed with him. They should have destroyed her when they had the chance.
Did anyone say why they didn't?
Luis Cesar asked. No. None of Claire's guards were alive then. But they said it probably had something to do with the old religion, that her judges would have felt like they were killing off part of the soul of Faerie if they completely obliterated her, and that maybe they thought she'd get it right the next time.
That's what I'm afraid of, he murmured.
Marlowe didn't seem any happier. His brows had lowered, and his eyes had darkened. Several of the vamps around me fidgeted, feeling their master's growing displeasure in their own bodies. This close, they functioned almost like a single organism, to the point that when Marlowe made another of those angry little noises, several of his boys did too. Sounded like a bunch of asthmatic cats in here, I thought. But he wasn't ready to officially board the crazy train yet.
None of this proves that she's still around today, he pointed out. Even if she did become a vampire, and eventually the praetor, as you claim, the consul killed her 500 years ago.
The consul killed her physically, I corrected, in fury after Mircea explained who had been murdering all those vampires. What she didn't know was that she was dealing with the reincarnated soul of an ancient Fae princess in a vampire body.
Understandable,
Luis Cesar murmured dryly. And so didn't realize that her nemesis remained, just in an altered form, because Alfilt was Vargr.
Based on? Marlowe cut in.
I looked at him incredulously. Did you hear anything I said about what happened here the other night? The Manlikans might have been a Freetus trying to get Aiden out of the house, but the Vargr attack definitely wasn't. The person doing that didn't know she already had a potential avatar in the room and couldn't have cared less about Aiden. She went straight for the troll kid, the only living witness to what Alfilt had been doing.
That doesn't prove anything. There are other Vargrs.
The plural is Vargr, and I wasn't finished yet. In Faerie, she was known as Alfild and Bofthi, Alfild the Two-Headed. It's a common nickname for Vargr. It's probably how she escaped from that tower the Fae imprisoned her in, and it's definitely how she got away from the consul. Her body died, but she threw her consciousness into her secretary.
Who just let her ride him around for the last 500 years?
Marlowe scoffed. He didn't have a choice. Something happened to him that night when Mircha and the witch stole the shield. I called Mircha while we were waiting for you, and he filled me in on some of the things they figured out afterward. He thinks Alfhild intended to put all the power she was stealing from those vampires into a single receptacle, knowing that the consul would call up a sandstorm during their duel. As soon as the view of the fight was obscured, the praetor would hit her with all that power all at once, crippling her, then finish her off on her own, making it look like she'd won the duel fair and square. It was a good plan, if she'd been faster. But she knew how powerful the consul was and wanted to make sure she overpowered her, so she was still collecting bones when Mircha and the witch discovered her plans and made their escape. She hadn't even had the receptacle made yet, but suddenly she was hours, perhaps only minutes away from an enraged consul if she couldn't find them.
"She put the power in the shield, didn't she?" Luis Cesar asked.
He hadn't heard this part before. I hadn't gotten this far last time, but no one's ever accused him of being slow. I nodded. It was the only thing she had on hand strong enough to hold that much energy, because it was designed for traveling through the ley lines. So she had one of her mages spell it to absorb the power in the bones. I don't know if she planned to stay and fight or run and try her luck later, but either way, she wanted her stolen power with her.
"But Mircha stole it first."
Marlowe suddenly grinned, showing fang. I couldn't remember if I'd ever seen him smile before, but it was disturbing. I decided I liked him angry better.
Yeah, but not before the shield almost killed her avatar. Mircha said he thought she must have been using her secretary to oversee the operation in Venice based on the height of the fishermen he'd been chasing. The praetor was paranoid and didn't trust anyone besides herself to manage things. So she rode her secretary around to have her cake and eat it too, and to have plausible deniability if anyone found out what was going on.
"That is why he received favored status among her servants," Luis Cesar said. "I did wonder what a non-master was doing in such an important place in her household."
But he paid for it that night. He tried to use the altered shield to suck the life out of Mircha, but instead the witch turned it back on him. He didn't die, but Alfhild was left with a crippled avatar, or else we'd have heard from her before this.
"That's absurd," Marlowe said, no longer smiling. "Who the hell would choose to live like that? With two consciousnesses in a single body?"
I stared at him, wondering if it had been deliberate. But I guess not, because he flushed suddenly, as realization hit. And for once, Marlowe actually looked flustered.
"I didn't mean..."
"Someone who wanted revenge badly enough." I cut him off because we didn't have time for this. Reincarnation ran the risk of her not remembering who she was next time. We don't know how many human lifetimes she lived before one was long enough to jog her memory. What if it never happened again? As for the secretary, he was weak, but any other body she chose would have fought her, whereas he probably didn't have the strength. Or maybe he didn't want to. Alfhild knew how the vampire world worked and could protect him. In his weakened state, who else would have bothered?
"So he was the albino we saw at the fights," Luis Cesar said. "With Alfhild in control."
I nodded. And back to her old tricks. The parallels between the praetor and our current problem were everywhere. Preying on the same type of vulnerable communities, using the same method with the bones, even having the same target. But they were separated by 500 years, so whenever I noticed anything, I put it down to coincidence.
"Which it probably is," Marlowe said, resuming asshole mode and pissing me off.
"Damn it, Marlowe!" I slapped my hands down, sending flour billowing. "Do you think I like this? I'd prefer for you to be right. Then the villain is in custody and all's right with the world. Instead, I have to deal with the fact that I left a friend to be used by that thing and ignored every hint he gave me."
"Friend?" Marlowe's guy said, his forehead wrinkling. "I thought we were talking about some albino."
I put a hand to my head and contemplated having an aneurysm. Okay, I said, one more time. Alfhild is a disembodied consciousness. She needs a body in order to get around and execute her revenge. At first, she took over her secretary because he was loyal and didn't fight her. But after he died at the burnt-out building fight, she needed a replacement and she needed one fast.
Because Vargar can't hold free flight, Luis Cesar said. At least somebody had been paying attention, I thought gratefully.
Yes. After her former avatar ended up under a burning truck, she had to find another. And she only had minutes before her consciousness scattered. And for an on-the-fly choice, James was a damned good one.
Luis Cesar agreed. A Circle member tasked with combating the smuggling trade was the perfect way to find out how close we were getting to whatever she is doing.
Yeah, like ruining a good man's life, I thought. He must have seen something change on my face.
Your friend is a war mage, he told me quietly. He knew the risks.
He has two little girls, I told him back, and a father who relies on him more every year. He's been talking about transferring to training duty because he wants to watch his kids grow up. I cut off, because if I didn't, my voice was going to change, and I didn't need my voice to change. I needed to kill something. Not someone, something. A thing that should have died millennia ago, but which instead was riding James around town like a sports car and doing God knew what kind of damage in the process. Even if I got him back, I wasn't sure I'd get him back.
You were unconscious, Luis Cesar reminded me. You didn't even see your friend that night.
But I did a couple nights later at the warehouse, and I knew he was acting strange. James doesn't know who Fra Filippo Lippi was, or swan around like Darth Vader, or threatened to send innocent people back to a war zone to die. And he was there that night, when that bitch lost her previous avatar. He told me so himself. Probably deliberately, like all those theatrics, because she didn't know his mannerisms, but I did. He was trying to get my attention, hoping I'd start asking questions, but instead... Instead, I just left him there. With her. There was a brief silence, which of course was broken by Marlowe.
So according to you, Alfhild is back and looking for revenge?
Not just according to me. Dorina recognized the albino as the Praetor's old secretary. Not at first. They were in the middle of a chase, and it had been 500 years. But soon...
And started sending your memories because she thinks history is about to repeat itself?
I nodded.
How the hell does that work? He demanded. If Alfhild had won that fight in Venice, she'd have ruled the vampire world, or a sizable portion of it. But now... If she exists at all, she's a shadow, a phantom, an echo of what she once was. What can a shadow do?
Almost killed the consul, Luis Cesar said dryly.
That was a one-off. Those damned weapons use life energy, not conventional magic. It led our wards to recognize them as people instead of arms.
People? I asked.
Marlowe grimaced. That's the problem with wards. They only know to look for what they've been told is a threat, and nobody uses life energy for weapons. It's too hard to come by. But while we figure out how to recalibrate, the consul is being well guarded.
Luis Cesar didn't look reassured.
You may have tightened security, but you've highlighted another problem. We're in New York City, one of the most densely populated areas in the country. If the weapons register as life energy, how are we supposed to find them?
Because we've been doing so great so far, one of Marlowe's guys muttered.
It was the same one as before, with an impressive fro and a problem keeping his mouth shut. But he wasn't wrong. He was talking about the great weapons hunt, which had started when the albino died, and his fellow slavers lost no time raiding his warehouse. Literally no time. They were at it before the flames died down on the truck, They'd robbed him blind, knowing that the Circle was busy at the burnt-out building and that his people were trying to hunt down escaped slaves. As a result, the overpowered weapons ended up in the hands of smugglers all